Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio. From creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences, to audio secrets, here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. I'm Vincent Diamante, and as usual, recording from Southern California with the trio. It's me, Alex, and Mike. Mike isn't too far away. How are things going on the other side of Los Angeles for me, Mike?
Well, I haven't set foot outside my house all day, so I couldn't really tell you authoritatively, but it's a little cool for my liking. I'm in a summer mindset, and I want the meteorology to fall into that expectation.
We're going to have plenty of that in a couple of months. I figure these nice, cool days are... I don't mind them at all. If anything, I can't wait for it to be a little bit rainy. I mean, everywhere is experiencing drought, so give me some more cool and hopefully some rain to go along with that. But that's a California thing. We're always worried about that drought stuff. You're not typically worried about that up in Sweden, are you, right, Alex?
No, drought is not one of the things that most Swedish people find themselves worrying about too much. It's normally the opposite of drought, which is snowstorms, I think is probably the most, the worst sort of natural disaster that happens up here. But having lived in Japan for 16 years, I would say that I much prefer a snowstorm over an earthquake. So, and actually having grown up in Australia, where of course drought is all too familiar, I'll take snowstorms over earthquakes and drought, thanks.
Well, don't knock until you've tried it.
Yeah. Well, I've tried all three of them, so I can't recommend earthquakes, and drought's not fun because you kind of get thirsty. So, let's stick with snowstorms, shall we? Actually, the funny thing is I heard from my friend, so today here in Stockholm it was a little bit rainy, and it's a bit cool. It's about 10 degrees centigrade, which is, I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, something amazing. Rather cool, anyway. And my friend in Austria said actually today is 31, and I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit either, but it's probably about 20 degrees more, roughly. That's how it works, isn't it? Fahrenheit to Celsius conversion?
Depends on the
kind of. Sort of, kind of.
Anyway,
I mean, I just remember like 30 is about 85, which is, you know, starting to get uncomfortable depending on other things like humidity and whatnot.
Yeah, it's funny. You think of Europe as being a relatively sort of small place, but then somehow it's 20 degrees warmer in Austria compared to Sweden. Oh, speaking of Europe, is Eurovision anything that anybody has ever heard of or ever watches in America?
Some people care about that. Not me in particular. I heard my wife talking about it, though.
Okay. Yeah, Eurovision was last weekend. And as usual, it's a bit of a spectacle. You don't watch it for the music, that's for sure. You watch it for the strangely veiled political undertones and the and of course the costumes and the dancing, and it's all about the image. It's not that much about the music, but it's this year, no surprises that the Ukraine won, and second to the Ukraine was the United Kingdom, which is kind of humorous because the last 5 years the United Kingdom has failed to sort of score highly at all. And my son and I have a theory that the reason for that is that generally the people in the UK don't really care that much about Eurovision. And it's probably done like that intentionally because, you know, the United Kingdom is such a powerhouse of you know, development in pop music that if they sent some good stuff to Eurovision every year, they'd just, you know, wipe the floor with the competition every single year. And that would just be far too predictable and not very entertaining. So they... Our theory is that they intentionally send the worst that they've got just so that to give the other countries a fair chance. And, you know, otherwise it would end up being like the Euro Cup in football, wouldn't it? It'd be like England versus Germany every single year. Anyway,
huh.
I digress. Eurovision was last weekend, and it was it happened. You need politics, or several million social media followers, or you need sex. If you have one of those three things in your performance, you will win Eurovision. That is the key. So that's my short summary.
Seems like it would be a disappointment to a singer who went to compete to find that the winning singer perhaps got a sympathy vote rather than an artistic vote.
Well, you know, I mean, it's the good thing about Eurovision is everybody goes into it knowing what to expect. It's you know, I mean, you can't take it too seriously. It's just a bit of fun. I have to say, though, this year in particular, with everything that's going on in Europe right now, it was actually quite refreshing just to have some, you know, rather inane musical entertainment. I guess maybe not musical, but just sort of visual entertainment. just sort of innocent, happy, you know, pretend none of the problems are there kind of fun. It's very nice. And, yeah, of course, I'm Australian, which means I'm, you know, I was brought up on Eurovision every year, which is why Australia, I don't know if you knew that Australia is actually part of Eurovision. Isn't that weird? It's like completely bonkers to anybody in Europe. But if you're from Australia, then it makes total sense. Of course.
Yeah. Anyway, you do got that Union Jack around your flag, right? So that's
somehow. Well, yeah. Well, somehow New Zealand isn't in Eurovision, or many of the other Commonwealth countries, actually any of the other Commonwealth countries. But anyway, let's talk about okay. Game audio, shall we?
Game audio.
I was wondering what kind of segue were we going to use to get out of this pit?
Yeah, no segues.
I was actually about to talk about snow, because on Twitter, which is a really great place to just find all sorts of interesting game audio tips and workflow and, you know, interesting ideas about how to execute certain bits of audio design. I saw some tweets actually from some Naughty Dog sound designers that were talking about how they used a VST synth instrument to basically do some Foley performance on a MIDI keyboard of footsteps in the snow.
Oh, cool.
You know, considering that snow is such a, you know, a granular thing, just loaded up a bunch of these very small sounds that are some of them sampled, some of them synth, and you just sort of perform them by walking on the MIDI keyboard, either super lightly or super heavily for this snow scene that they were scoring. And I thought, wow, that's actually really cool. There are some VSTs that are bespoke for Foley. You can find things for footsteps and other types of stuff. You know, just because your VST doesn't necessarily mean that music is going to be at the forefront. But this was, you know, some sound designers that were appropriating this synth sampler and turning it into a footstep Foley thing. And I thought it looked and sounded very good.
That's excellent. I'm all for that. I think as this known by longtime listeners of the Game Audio Hour, I enjoy quite a lot, actually, synthesizing sounds instead of using field recordings or library recordings. Actually, the very first project that I did for a major publisher actually was entirely synthesized, which was such a stupid move.
I thought that it was amazing when you said it. And I kept on going back to that whenever I saw the trailers and footage that were made public. I thought, wow, this is going to be so cool. I cannot wait to play it. And, it didn't quite happen that way, unfortunately. I mean, that's games industry for you.
Yeah, that's right. So the project was canceled before it ever saw the light of day. And unfortunately, the company that I was working for then didn't own the IP to it. It was owned by the publisher. So there's nothing that could be done with any of the assets for that. But yeah, you know what? I won't talk too much about this time, because I know I've talked about it before, but it was not a smart move. I had like 2 years or something to do all the sounds and the music for this rather expansive game. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do something different and I'm going to synthesize everything. And yeah, just not smart. I think I thought when I made that decision that it would be a nice way to add sort of an aesthetic flavor, a certain specific flavor onto the game. If I was trying to synthesize realistic sounds, so not using a synth to make, like, you know, retro sounds or anything like that, but actually trying to synthesize as best as I can realistic sounds using synthesizers. And a lot of the sounds that I made actually came out sounding quite realistic, but it was kind of pointless, really, because at the end of the day, it just took me a very, very long time. And because my goal was to achieve realism in synthesized sound, it begs the question, why not just use a recording? Because then it's real.
Why bother? I'll play devil's advocate on your behalf. One of the advantages, I imagine, of a synthesized sound is flexibility. So if you make a synthesized footstep, you can get variations very easily without having to resort to minor pitch shifting and time compression and stuff like that. So that seems to be a real advantage to going the synthesized route.
Yeah, that's probably the only advantage. And that's one thing that I still do very often these days when I'm doing sound design work, is I may just sort of layer a library recording up with a synthesized section as well. And then, yeah, as you said, I mean, if you're using any one of these modern day VSTs that emulates analog hardware or some kind of, you know, non-linearities from hardware synthesizers, then yeah, basically you just trigger the same note again and again and it will sound slightly different every time. So that is probably the only advantage of having done it that way. I look back at it now and think, wow, it just took me a whole long time to make something that sounds sort of semi-realistic. So why not just use realistic sources instead?
Well,
but, you know, it was a learning process, and I'd certainly learnt my tools and learnt a lot about synthesis through that. So, yeah, no regrets.
Let me segue this into a related question, and I'm sure you have the answer. When we think of musical instruments, one of the main techniques of creating virtual instruments is modeling. And, you know, the advantages of a modeled instrument are they're lightweight, they don't take up a lot of hard drive footprint, and they have almost infinite configurability, much like we were just talking about with your hypothetical synthesized footstep. So if I use the Pianotech digital piano, I can just decide to tweak the hardness of the hammers and, you know, play with any of the simulated physical properties of this imaginary piano. In a way you couldn't do with a sample, except through trickery, you know, with EQ and so forth, but you can literally break the physics of the piano down and change things. So do there exist sound design analogs of music, of modeled musical virtual instruments, where there is like a VST for, well, to steal our own example, like a footstep that's been purely synthesized, but in a kind of acoustic modeling way that then could be changed, where you could tweak the number of nails in the sole and the size of the foot and obviously terrain and other things like that?
Probably Vince would be more familiar with the tools these days that, because I think you were just mentioning just now, but I know that, is it Krotos? They have a bunch of plugins that, I don't know that they're modeling things. I think in those cases, they're drawing from a huge library of, you know, source sampled sound, and the interface just allows you to very easily tweak and mix and combine and find interesting permutations of the source sounds. I don't know if any of those tools actually do it from, you know, from the ground up as a modeled algorithm. Do you know, Vince, are there any that do it that way?
I think there are. The first thing that came to mind was actually GameSynth. It's this Japanese company, Tsugi. Actually, I can't remember if it started out as a French company or as a Japanese company, but I think now they're based in Japan. And they make this thing called GameSynth, which sort of straddles the line between being an end-user creative tool for creating assets, as well as being a game engine. And you can utilize the resources that are there in order to make different types of things, ostensibly for games, but they provide all sorts of different models for different types of synthesis of the basics of what are in games, you know, footsteps, gunshots, collision, you know, basic user interface stuff, machine type stuff. I'm actually kind of refreshing myself on their website right now. And they're just talking about how, yes, everything is procedural, it's lightweight, everything is synthesis, and you could either utilize the models as stuff that is being driven in-game or as part of the user-facing editing tool where you utilize the models and create assets for something else. And it's pretty cool. I actually have a license for this, but I have to admit, I have not updated my version of GameSynth in probably about 2 years. And I keep on getting reminded by them in emails and tweets and whatnot that you can just keep on updating and the new versions are bigger and better than ever. They have more models. It seems really cool. There are some very fantastic sounding demos for this new 2022 version of GameSynth, but I personally haven't actually used it for any of my work.
I think it's also worth mentioning Wise, Audio Kinetic Wise has it has a wind synth. Also, I think there's an impact engine that you can purchase as an additional thing to use together with Wise. And obviously, there's a bunch of car engine kinds of thing. I believe, I'm not sure about the car engine ones, but the wind synth and the impact one, I believe, are actually synthesized. Maybe, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think you're also right about the car engine one in that it is drawing mostly on samples and they are really pushing on the realism. You can dial in a very specific car model and then use that as the base for whatever your fictional car is going to be.
Mm.
Whenever we face the question of samples versus, I'll call it modeling, even though the term may not be used universally, there's this really interesting question of what will give you better results. And you know, in most musical contexts, the answer still seems to be sampled instruments, with a few exceptions for instruments that I think lend themselves to modeling. And I think what Modart is doing with Pianotech is a great example. I have less intuitions about how the trade-off stands with sound design elements these days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's, as I learnt the hard way, keeping up with a production schedule when you are trying to synthesize things from nothing is just not very efficient, really, unless you're going for a specific, I mean, for example, Space Folk City, the game that Vince and I worked on together, a lot of the user interface sounds and the sounds related to the things that the characters in the game are doing, intentionally we wanted them to sound synthetic and we wanted them to sound like an analog, a modular analog synthesizer, kind of squelches and things like that. So in that case, obviously, using a synthesizer makes total sense as opposed to samples. When it comes to, you know, just the, what would you call them? The padding sounds, you know, the bread and butter stuff, like, you know, closing a door or like, you know, footsteps on the ground or like, you know, impacts or things like that. It's just far faster to turn to, you know, sampled sound libraries, I think. So it just depends on the end goal at the end of it, and also the time frame, and of course, I guess budget has a little bit to play in it as well.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. I imagine that the investment in infrastructure for synthesized or modeled sounds pays off more the more persistent, like somebody who's in-house and maybe developing a system for managing sound assets for maybe a game franchise has a kind of a long time period to set up infrastructure. And in that case, something like, you know, thinking of how a synthesis system might be adapted for a game or game franchise might make more sense than a freelancer who's called in for one project.
That's right. Of course, if that freelancer will have their own library that they take around with them. and they will also have their own, you know, experience with certain synthesizers. Certainly so that project that I mentioned where I decided to do it all with synthesis, that was about 9 years ago. Obviously the landscape of software synthesizers was somewhat different then. I used Yuhi's Zebra and also Native Instruments Prism, which is Zebra was basically for 80% of things, and then Prism was used specifically for the metallic sounds because it can do that. It's additive kind of comb filter style synthesis that can do a whole bunch of very metallic sounds very easy, in the same way that Chromaphone works, except a little bit more versatile than Chromaphone. So going through that project, obviously now I'm very familiar with those two tools. A freelancer will come into a project with their own experiences and their own bank of their own recorded sounds and library sounds that they've purchased across the years. So I guess it balances out in the end.
Right now I'm actually looking at a couple of different Foley things. Because I was trying to find something that is doing more of a synth approach, and it seems like all the Foley stuff, all the VSTs and sound design tools that I'm finding that are specifically for Foley performance, they're all based on samples. Like right now I'm on UVI's website, and they have something called Walker. I'll just read straight from the website. A comprehensive, flexible, and easy-to-use sound design tool that delivers everything you need, et cetera, built on a library of over 25,000 samples. Walker lets you choose any combination of 3 different mic pairs, placed near and far, 6 types of shoes, 14 ground surfaces with ground effects, and 8 types of clothing. I guess, you know, multiply some numbers and that's how you get your 25,000 samples. And then there's some other effects and modulation that you could do to further massage it to your specific use case. But yeah, lots of sample-based stuff. But
UVI is maybe not such a good example, though, because most of UVI's products are based on Falcon, and Falcon is their, you know, contact killer, their massive sampling engine. So I think all of their products that they do are basically all based on Falcon under the hood. So they're all sample-based.
Right. I mean, they do have some stuff that is... Oh, yeah, I'm looking at it. They do have recreations of older synth instruments, and they're all just samples of those instruments. Okay.
Yeah, but they're all really, really good. I'm actually quite a big fan of UVI's stuff. As I mentioned before, I purchased the electric keyboard suite on a Black Friday sale last year, or this year, or whenever it was. And it's become pretty much my most used non-synthesizer VST. It's so good.
Really?
Yeah, it's so good. Like all of the, you know, the Wurlitzer and the Rhodes piano and the Yamaha stage piano and all these rare kind of 70s and 80s electric pianos. They're all based on samples. But honestly, yeah, they're really, really good. So actually, I recently also purchased their string synthesizer library. So that one also is all samples again, but it's basically a sort of a chronicle, a timeline history of vintage string synthesizers. And again, it's just great. I mean, they're massive sample libraries, but it's fantastic. They sound really, really good.
Okay, that's good to know. I mean, I'm taking that as pretty high praise considering how much of a synth head you are and a stickler for details and quality like that. So, okay.
Yeah, They're kind of cheating, because one thing I've noticed that they do is they, with I think pretty much all of their sample libraries when they're sampling synthesizers, they actually have a bit of saturation on them. So by default, that like the drive knob will be up at like 20% on everything. So... You know, that means when you're playing it, you get it out, you load it up, you play something, it's like, wow, great, that's like all sparkly and thick and juicy, and that's just what I'm looking for. So I guess it's, obviously it's not cheating. I mean, that's, you know, saturation. Sure, that's going to make a synthesizer sound good, especially when it's applied subtly. But I think that's kind of the way they win you. And I'm sold. It's great.
At least you're aware of the phenomenon.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, now I'm wondering about that because I basically do that as a default for all of my outboard instrument gear. I have it running through either this tube preamp or something else, just driving it a little bit more. Yes, driving it a little bit more than I should because it just sounds a little bit better that way.
Yeah.
But if it's built in there in the software, Okay.
That's right.
Note to Vince during editing, please add a little bit of saturation to my voice.
He always does. He always does.
No wonder I always feel good about myself when I listen to this show.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, let's see. Before the show, we were actually talking about how we maybe shouldn't dwell too much on gear. So maybe we've filled our quota here.
Let's move on. Now, you both mentioned that you had an interesting topic to raise during this show, and I actually don't know what it is, so I am ready. Shock me.
Interesting to me, for sure. So, like much of the game-playing nation, I was getting slaughtered yesterday while playing Elden Ring, and the experience of playing the game has made me think a little bit about what I'll call open-world sword games, and the approach and problems to atmospheric music that comes up with this genre of game. So to maybe define the category a bit, what I'm referring to are games that have open world that have a component of exploration, but specifically those that are set in a kind of pre-industrial genre. Elder Scrolls, Elden Ring, maybe Breath of the Wild, Dragon Age, Witcher, you know, all these games that have kind of medieval trappings, hence sword games. And what unifies them in one way is the fact that since there's not a lot of technology, you don't have a lot of urban sound ambience. You're often walking through forests or mountains or deserts, and therefore there's a lot of acoustic space open for music, in a way that might not be the case if you were in sort of a cyberpunk environment. So another thing that unifies these games, if we think of the experience of playing them, is that we spend a lot of time in them. You know, these are usually dozens of hours of gameplay. And a lot of that, you know, is typically spent, you know, walking through the wilderness. So there's a lot of time on your own, walking through a forest, etc., and with a fairly sparse acoustic environment. So the question that I think all these games face is what to do musically during this kind of open world exploration. I think extended gameplay experiences are particularly prone to the fatigue of looping because I think when we're exploring, a lot of our attention span is free compared to if we're in an active combat mode or if we're in dialogue or problem solving. But if you're just enjoying the scenery as you run or horseback ride around, I think there's enough of your brain free that you can sniff out when the music becomes repetitive. Would this match your guys' experience with these games?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of ironic, isn't it? Because you would think that in the dramatic parts of gameplay, you know, that's where I should be putting in the power into the music, you know, during combat or during a cutscene or things like that. Okay, it's time for the music to come to the forefront. However, ironically, the player is so consumed with so much else going on during those times, either, you know, a cutscene with the story and emotion and voiceover and the visuals, or during combat, obviously they're thinking about combat, that often the music, you know, is a little bit secondary to what's going on. However, in these more, you know, expansive, open, sort of doing nothing parts, these lulls of the game pacing, ironically, that's where the user, as you said, the player has the bandwidth to be actually listening to the music. So it's very challenging, isn't it? Like, that's it seems contradictory that it should be that way around. But yeah, I would imagine that so much more effort has to be put into parts of the game where nothing is happening compared to the opposite.
Now, I want to stress that when playing these games, there's a lot of enjoyment to be had from the exploration aspect. I would argue against the nothing is happening rule. I think there's, especially in Elden Ring, where the environment is so cool and macabre that there's a real joy in exploration. But nonetheless, it does not take up as many processing cycles in your brain. So yeah, there are a lot of opportunities, but as far as I know, and I have a limited swath of experience, obviously, but I don't know of any game like this that has really adopted generative music in order to create kind of continually new musical accompaniment for these very ambient moments. And I feel like for some games, at least, there must be an opportunity here to do that. But let me first start by questioning my own premises. Do any of you know a game kind of like this, kind of open world exploration, and I guess it doesn't have to be pre-industrial, but anything that has enough, that's quiet enough that you can appreciate the music, that instead of just randomly deploying one of a number of atmospheric pre-written cues, does something algorithmic or generative in terms of the music?
There was a part of me that wanted to just do that quick joke response, which is Rescue on Fractalis, because I think there is, in fact, somewhat generative music in there, but it's extremely, extremely simple. The guy who did the music, I think, what was it? Wait a minute, was it the same person that did the music for Ball Blazer? Which I know was, in fact, generative music, that did the generative jazz, but Fractalis music...
You mean the classic, like, the classic 1980s?
Yes, the classic Lucasfilm Games video game.
I don't remember there being... Fractalis. I'm old enough to remember the game. I don't remember there being music in it, though. It was innovative because it had its sort of procedurally generated terrain, which... was not at all common at that time, and it was really impressive, but I don't remember the audio at all.
Right. I mean, I got to admit, I don't remember it very well either. I remember the later Ball Blazer, because that did have... Okay, so it's slightly different. Peter Langston from Lucasfilm actually doing the music for Ball Blazer, and Charlie Kellner doing the music for Rescue on Fractalis. So, okay, maybe I'm not quite right there, and I sort of conflated two different games that were using generative stuff in different ways, the generative terrain of Rescue on Fractalis and the generative music of Ball Blazer. So, okay, feel free to ignore me from this point on.
When I think of the approaches in these games, there seem to be a couple of different ways to approach environmental or atmospheric or exploration music. You know, if you think of the now classic Elder Scrolls Skyrim, and I think Oblivion before it, the idea is that they would just write, they had a lot of music. They just had tons of atmospheric music. And it was so gorgeous, especially in the case of Skyrim, that I personally did not mind, you know, hearing yet another iteration of the same Jeremy Soule atmospheric piece. They sort of hammered in through sheer power of beauty. They gave you the same musical accompaniment. And obviously the music would change according to locations. If you enter a dungeon, it's going to be different. If you enter a town, I'm really just thinking of the exploration. With Dragon Age 3, for some reason, I'm remembering that one. It seemed like the approach was they had these little kind of underscore fragments, like these little musical phrases almost, that would just be deployed in isolation. So you'd be running through the woods and you'd hear like a trumpet call, and it would last maybe 5 or 10 seconds, and that would be it. So, and then there'd be a long gap of silence and you'd hear another sort of musical fragment. What I think was intended with that approach was to steer clear of recognizable melodies so you didn't get loopitis. They tried to steer clear of the Elder Scrolls approach, but I remember playing that game and thinking it was actually distracting because it was like like a trumpet player wandered into the scene and was like, oh, I'm sorry, this isn't where my gig is. And he wandered off. You got like this short musical fragment. What I have not played Breath of the Wild. Does anyone remember what the musical approach is there for The Wild?
Breath of the Wild was a little different because it was much more continuous when it happened and it was tied to player state. So when you are in battle, you have a pretty solid battle music, which is in contrast to, say, Elden Ring, because like you can be in battle with, you know, a couple random people here and there that you see and it's just whatever. But of course, you come across the big bosses and then there is, in fact, a big bespoke tune just for that boss battle. Breath of the Wild, you transition into battling and then you hear music at that point. And then let's say you want to get out of there, you get on your horse and you just ride. Once you get a sufficient distance away and you're in that riding state for a while, the music is the music of you riding your steed for 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and it actually just keeps on going. It's a light orchestration for a very small ensemble, not a big orchestra, but it is a full fleshed out cue for your player state.
That's interesting. I don't know, I feel like, so in these games, depending on the style and the aesthetic of the game, there are times when I think you do really want to hear something melodic or thematic or harmonically very composed sounding. You know, you want those Skyrim Witcher 3 moments where there is some kind of theme that evokes the city you're in or the forest you're tromping through. But I was thinking when playing Elden Ring in particular, that there's a, at least for a game like that, there's an opportunity for maybe generative music that could have been taken that wasn't. So Vince, you've been playing the game. So my feeling with the game is because the world is in ruins, you know, it's fragmented. There isn't a huge living footprint or thumbprint of humanity. Everything's kind of undead, right? And that gives the game license to do things that we wouldn't always find realistic, like your enemies sitting there motionlessly waiting for you to come day in, day out, having no other agenda like food or, you know, conversation. They just stand there waiting for you. And that's cool because everything's undead-ish, right? So, and the music tends to be a bit austere when you are riding or walking through the world. It's a lot of it, at least in Limgrave, which is where I've been predominantly playing, mm-hmm. that it's kind of you're hearing high string intervals in a way that is extremely effective in giving you this lost civilization, lost ruins of civilization, kind of lonely, forlorn feeling. But I do recognize these intervals. Like whenever you get back into exploration mode, I'm like, oh, yeah, there's that string line. And I thought, you know, they could very easily have, because the music is so simple in these cases, why not just kind of distill the essence of this particular composition and generate semi-random intervals atmospherically and continue the musical texture without the sense of constant repetition? I think a game like that would be, or anything that does not need to be overtly melodic by dint of its artistic style, could really get a lot of mileage out of doing something like that. Even if with a live orchestra, you could record fragments, and then if they're non-specific enough, you could combine them in interesting ways, you know, gradually, lyrically, slowly, so that you don't hear obvious gaps or moments where you can kind of hear the algorithmic engine churning. But I think that it could be done, and I'm curious if, you know, any game has ever taken an approach like that to avoid the loopitis phenomenon.
Is it possible, I haven't actually played Elden Ring, but is it possible that this may have been an intentional choice, that they're actually wanting to use the repetition to establish a kind of, you know, a signature or something memorable for a certain area or a certain activity, something that you would always, you know, remember? Oh, I remember when I was here last, I heard that. Or, you know, when you hear the music and you're not playing the game, it takes you back to that moment. Is there a chance it was an intentional choice to use that repetition?
Hard to say. You know, the music is often so atmospheric and so athematic and so unmelodic that it doesn't seem like there's a real advantage in that case. of thematic recognition. Whereas, you know, main titles or maybe battle music or boss music, then there is something cool when you recognize a theme or some signature. It seems like the music is much more about instrumentation and texture. I remember I was crawling around a castle and there was kind of this really gnarly cello line or something cello-like, like a viol. I was thinking like, yeah, that's really cool. But I wasn't necessarily jamming on the notes it was playing so much as the fact that it was there playing, you know, something in natural minor, or something chromatic or octatonic or something like that. So it seems like what makes sense for the signature is the sound and orchestration and texture and tempo, and not necessarily the particular note choices. And that's why it might lend itself to a generative approach.
I think that would be really, really cool. But as it is, I actually struggle to think about how you would actually make that happen. Not so much that it can't happen. I really can imagine how it could work, but it has to work in development, where what you would want is basically AI John Zorn just sort of sitting on top of your game engine, telling your bits and pieces to actually do things in a particular way, rather than, you know, distinct pieces of music that have a conductor score, that have player parts that they'll just play through and you'll record it and there's your 3-minute cue right there. You know, Elden Ring is interesting. It's not exactly the approach that I would have done if I was on there. I would probably lean towards what can I do in order to make AI John Zorn, basically. You look at the soundtrack and you do in fact have cues connected to these spots in this mostly unbroken continuous world where, all right, you've got 3 minutes of this and 4 minutes of this, and you go into the catacombs here and it's 3 minutes of this. But I agree, it doesn't need to be that. And I think if it wasn't that, it probably would be rather more effective.
I think a hybrid approach would be a practical way to approach a game like this, where you pick out the moments where you really need composed music, where you want something recognizable and something very specific. And then maybe somewhere in the exploration part of the world, you develop these palettes and where the music needs to be sparse but present. And then you experiment a little bit with, 20th century composition came up with all these tools for essentially algorithmic music. It wasn't called that, but that's what it was. Tone rows and all the Schoenbergian, schools of composition, and all these obscure, like, mathematical systems for coming up with pitches that composers were using to no great artistic end at the end of the day, unless you're, you know, a real enthusiast. But I think these kind of approaches could be incorporated into generative music for games, particularly the kind of, atonal, alienated musical palette scores for games. I think it could be done very effectively.
I agree. I immediately thought, wasn't this called game music? Like, you look at, say, the Harvard Dictionary of Music from back in the 80s or 90s, and if you search game music, they're not going to say related to video games. They're going to say game music, like, John Zorn's Cobra, or, Xenakis, or, all these other late 20th century musicians that did interesting things when it came to breaking up the music ensemble, breaking up the structures, the older structures of composer and conductor and player, and playing around with them in interesting ways in order to create interesting performances. And I think there are some really useful things that we can draw on from that in creating the soundtracks for these games. However, the soundtracks for these games are so much rooted in our understanding of a piece of music as this 4-minute thing that can eventually be turned into an MP3 that could be streamed on Spotify and whatnot. And because of that, I wonder how willing someone would be in exploring a different strategy.
Do you mean the sense of a composer being reluctant because, you know, we like our albums and we like there being a kind of a concrete record of our creativity?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. There's also the whole thing of how does one get hired? You know, if you hire me, I will give you 50 minutes of music, and we understand how 50 minutes of music can be billed, and, you know, people can understand what 50 minutes of music is from a work and effort standpoint, from a final delivery standpoint, versus here is this maybe somewhat hard to grasp or unwieldy concoction of design and code and music and sound assets. And how do we contract that? How do we build that? And I think it's not impossible. It's just a certain barrier there. There's a certain difficulty in that that I think would put people off on that from various sides of this whole equation.
I agree. There are definitely human sociological factors and that impact a decision like this. I think tying it back to our hypothetical footstep synthesizer, you know, things like this probably lend themselves to persistent franchises with full-time employees who can also have an R&D component to their job and might be investing in a system for a series of games, like, you know, from Software with their kind of artistically linked series of games, you know, a company like that. I have no idea how they work in terms of, I don't know if they have in-house composers or contractors they love, but you could imagine a persistent company that was working in what I'll call it like a problem domain, meaning like a series of games that are kind of overlapped artistically and maybe musically, wanting to come up with a system that could, to some extent, come up with generative music for moments where it made sense and could provide variety at the cost of, you know, the coherence of a human compositional signature. I think that makes sense for contexts where you don't need that kind of like a drum based combat music, for example. I'm sure people have experimented with sort of random variations in that trope, that musical trope. That's got to be something that's already done. And I don't mean in terms of just layering and removing layers. I mean where the rhythms themselves are generative, or variations of the rhythms are generative. So that's another example of a musical problem domain that would lend itself. But we're going a little, I realize we're going far afield from my original topic of what do you listen to when you're looking at forests. But there seems to be some potential there.
Mm-hmm.
I personally, I've not actually had that much experience with a soundtrack that is procedural, or at least maybe I didn't notice, which means maybe I have played some games with a procedural soundtrack, I just didn't notice it. But I actually kind of like the repetition. You know, if it's nice music, I like that confirmation of, okay, here is the music for doing this, or here is the music for this area. One game that comes to mind for me is Elite Dangerous. And in Elite Dangerous, when you're not in combat, when you're just flying through space, it's basically, it's, you know, sort of like a fairly standard implementation in that they've got these orchestral cues that are basically being triggered somewhat randomly, depending on where in space you are, and a few other parameters. And they're purely textural. There's not much thematic in there. But I really like it. And especially now, you know, when I'm watching, because I don't play Elite Dangerous anymore, because it's sadly has suffered a very, very sad fate, as any players of the game listening right now would know what that's all about. So I don't play it anymore. But whenever I hear, you know, those texture cues in, like, you know, gameplay videos or stuff on YouTube, I'm always reminded, oh yeah, that's right. And it brings back, you know, the feeling and the memories of playing, even though it's not thematic, there's no melody there, it's just a textural orchestral cue taken from a pool of, you know, several. The looping aspect, especially when it's textural like that and not melodic, I personally actually like it. So, I mean, of course, I understand that procedural music for that kind of application doesn't necessarily mean not looping and not repetitive, but that hybrid approach that you mentioned earlier on there, Mike, I think that's where, for me personally, I like that. You know, I like it when it's recognizable and to a certain degree somewhat repetitive.
Yeah, I also like that too. and I don't think this is really, when I'm thinking about what we've just been saying, I don't think this is really indicting any approach in particular, but more just sort of pointing out that there is space to explore even further when it comes to the execution. And I think that sometimes these games, like, you know, Elden Ring, I think does this where, you know, you're exploring the catacombs, you hear some stuff, you know, okay, we've got this interesting string texture that comes in for a few seconds and then goes back out and sort of melds back into the background and you just hear ambience at that point. And then, okay, you hear that and then you're still in these catacombs and you hear that exact same figure again a couple of minutes later. And it gets me thinking, as both a player and a music composer, it feels kind of like this music composer, or maybe the composer in conjunction with the designer, was worried about saying the right thing and hopefully not saying something that is inappropriate for the space that you're in, for the state that the player is in. But they are, in fact, saying something over the course of that particular repetition. So what else can be said? And is there some other structure with which to say what I would like to say, you know, with the music? You know, am I using the music to point out the atmosphere in the world? Okay, sure. What's needed to do that? I'm not sure that repeating the same music figure over the course of, you know, 30 minutes at 2-minute intervals is necessarily the best way to do that. So what else can be done? And I think there is something that could be done there, just a little bit more structure, a little bit more design, a little bit further in terms of what is there besides the notes, because it isn't about the notes with the score for Elden Ring, at least when we're looking at the ambience that pervades most of the areas and not the cinematic music, not the boss battles.
I'm going to have to play this Elden Ring game. Apparently it's pretty good.
It is a lot of fun.
I like it too, although I would say I'm mostly having fun watching my wife die in more and more interesting ways. I mean, those bosses are pretty scary, quite honestly. And, there is the hardcore gamer part of me that thinks, okay, I get this. I get the pattern that's going on here. All right. But, you know, the combination of the world that they're in, the boss, her particular weapon of choice, the sheer immersion and imposition of the world and the presentation on them as they are playing the game and getting frustrated and encountering things that they are eventually surpass. It's really quite entertaining. It's such a cool game. I wish I had a little bit more time to play games, honestly.
Don't we all?
That is the ironic tragedy of working in the game business.
Yeah, That's right.
I mean, we're getting into about an hour at this point, so that might be a natural segue into conspicuous consumption.
I agree. Let's talk about what we've been consuming. I haven't been playing video games, but maybe you two have. Alex, what have you been consuming lately?
Well, sadly or happily, I've been listening to the Blade Runner soundtrack in memory and tribute to Vangelis, who recently passed away, actually. I think it was a few days ago as of the recording of this podcast. Yeah, did you both see that news?
Yes.
Usually I'm not really one for giving that much attention to when, you know, famous people pass away. Yeah, but in this case, it was rather significant somehow, because to me, the Blade Runner soundtrack specifically, and of course I know that Vangelis has done a huge body of work outside that one particular soundtrack, but for me, the Blade Runner soundtrack kind of fills the same position and impact as 2001: A Space Odyssey, if you know what I mean. It's sort of that the first time I watched 2001: A Space Odyssey, it was kind of an interesting revelation that science fiction movies didn't have to be just about action, right? Because Kubrick's 2001 is not really an action movie. It's a very thoughtful, very cerebral science fiction movie. Of course, there's some tension and there's some action in it, but it's not like, you know, if you compare it to, say, Star Wars or, you know, those are action movies. And in this case, it's not really an action adventure. It's very much a cerebral kind of almost art house science fiction movie. And the Blade Runner soundtrack, I remember the very first time that I heard it when I was very young, it was kind of like, wow, you know, synthesizers don't have to be about dancing. obviously, I know that there's a whole genre of ambient music, but in the case of Vangelis' music for Blade Runner, yes, it's ambient, but it's extremely musical and extremely melodic at the same time. And you have these, you know, very distinctive, lush textures with the big Lexicon reverbs and the Yamaha CS80 right in the center of it all. And when you listen to that soundtrack, it goes beyond synthesizers as well. There's some beautiful music in there that is not purely synthesis, but yeah, for me, it sort of has that similar position of a every now and then it's like splashing water on your face and reminding yourself that synthesizers can do so much more than just dance music. You know, that there's such a huge range of texture and emotion and feeling that we can bring with synthesizers, you know, without the ubiquitous rhythmic connection that, you know, generally is what you associate with synthesized music. That's my piece. That's what I had to say. Thank you for listening.
I agree. Rest in peace. I think he was responsible for, I mean, he was probably one of the first people to really bring distinctly synthesized scores into mainstream cinema. I'm sure there were experimental projects that, you know, would have used like Milton Babbitt music and, you know, before then, but in terms of, you know, popcorn movies, things you could see in a major cinema, I don't know that there were a lot of examples of synthesizers, especially being used in a very expressive fashion for a traditional story like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other person who comes to mind is Wendy Carlos. However, Wendy Carlos, if you think of, for example, the original Tron soundtrack from 1984, Wendy Carlos's soundtrack is more akin to like a synthesized orchestral score, very Disney, but done with synthesizers. Whereas Vangelis' score for Blade Runner was not trying to be an orchestra at all. It was very, very distinct and very unique.
And of course, we should mention his pop hit, the Chariots of Fire theme.
Of course.
Probably brought him to the forefront of the American musical consciousness. The melody was on piano, but there was a good, healthy backdrop of synthesizers in that tune.
Yeah, that's right. Have you seen the movie, the original movie, The Chariots of Fire?
Maybe years ago.
I actually rewatched some of it. Okay. I decided to actually try streaming that yesterday after hearing the news. And honestly, it had been decades, one. So I had very, very fresh eyes and ears on this. But also, too, wow, it's so interesting thinking about the fact that Chariots of Fire is a period film. This is from the early 1900s, you know, and you've got a synthesizer soundtrack for it. It's, you know, when you say that, it seems absolutely ludicrous. It's like, hey, what are we going to use to score this Merchant Ivory film, you know, like Howard's End or Room with a View? You know, it's of course use some chamber orchestra, right?
Right.
You wouldn't use a CS80 or an emulator or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, here is a period film that uses an orchestra and uses it incredibly well. Honestly, I was listening to that and watching it, and I had chills as I was feeling the emotions of this, you know, pretty straightforward story. I mean, it's a period film. It's a sports film. It's not the most complex plot. It's not the some of the more heady stuff that you might see in the sci-fi world, for example. These are things that we're very familiar with if we're, you know, read in sort of the canon of literature and movies up to this point. But it's being conveyed with a synthesizer and the piano, yes, but the synthesizer texture that's used is so big and propulsive and emotive. And honestly, I just had, I really did have chills watching this thing that has been parodied so much and reduced to cliche. And you see the original and think, wow, no, this is really powerful. It's not just the thing that I've seen parodied for years and years and years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's probably Vangelis's greatest contribution to the synthesizer as a musical instrument. That is just sort of, you know, placing it in these contexts and using it in ways that is somewhat surprising, you know. I mean, obviously, the Blade Runner soundtrack being a, you know, really hard science fiction movie like that, of course, the synthesizer fits in, but then the way he uses it there is in this very, very sort of soft, arrhythmic, ambient way. And just the same with Chariots of Fire being a period film, there's the least place that you would expect to find a synthesizer, and there it is. And he pulls it off so well. And I know that he was always very, very conscious and very... He always prioritized performance, and I think that's one of the reasons that he... gravitated to the CS80, which was Yamaha's, you know, absolute dreadnought of a beast of a synthesizer, which had, I think it actually was one of the first synthesizers to have polyphonic aftertouch, wasn't it?
That sounds right to me, but I don't know off the top of my head.
I have this, I think I've seen a video interview with Vangelis where he's in his studio, and it's basically kind of looks like a, you know, somebody surrounded by two or three pipe organs with four or five manuals, you know, all these buttons keyboards everywhere. And he was discussing how, you know, performing the score is so much more important than just, you know, sequencing it or just composing it and having it play. Actually playing it yourself is a core part of how he captures, or at least what he felt is very important with capturing that human side to the synthesizer texture.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree with that. And I think that's been a big influence on me and how I actually produce my music. Like everything has to be performed. And I'm very, very reticent to click in notes or quantize or anything like that. There has to be that physical connection there from me.
Mm. Well, come on, Vince. Need to get back into some tracker. There's a physical connection with like typing up the melodies on the QWERTY keyboard, I would say.
Oh, I appreciate that too. I think that's really cool. But
yeah. How about you, Mike? What have you been consuming?
Well, I talked about Elden Ring last week, and indeed for long tracts of this particular episode. I could shift to books because I was reading a lot of kind of really well-written dystopian sci-fi. Did I talk about Wool at all?
No,
I don't think so.
I think the past few episodes, you've said you've been consuming the Elden Ring.
I have been, and I will continue. So that's going to be my answer for every like for video games with conspicuous consumption. But I read the Wool trilogy, which is a dystopian sci-fi novel that is particularly well written, and it without giving away too many spoilers, it takes place within a kind of a post-apocalyptic giant bunker city. where the civilization is there, and they don't know how they got there, and they don't know what happened, and they don't know anything about their forebears, and there's some shadowy authority. And what makes the book really compelling is that the author, he understands the nuts and bolts of machinery, or he understands it well enough to write about it in a way that's convincing. And he's thought through how a society like that could survive in isolation. For example, you know, there's like kind of a mining caste at the bottom of this underground silo, and they have to dig up new minerals. And when people die, their bodies are brought to the farms where they're used as fertilizer. So he really thought through, it's like there's good game design in his sci-fi world. And that combined with just kind of a great set of characters and a really cool mystery to unravel made the whole trilogy really compelling for me. So I recommend that.
Cool. What was the name of the author?
Good question. let me stall while I Google it. Yes, of course, it's Hugh Howey, H-U-G-E-H-H-O-W-E-Y. Yeah, the word wool is a little bit hard to Google, but if you Google wool book, you probably find it.
That was some quick draw Googling right there, Mike.
Thank you. I pride myself on that. Learned it in school.
Cool. All right. Well, it's been an hour, so I guess we should call it at that. This was episode 225 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice. And you could leave us a review to keep us moving forward, not backward, upward, not forward. What was it? And always twirling towards freedom. You can also follow us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, where we also post notices about future episodes, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the Twitterverse. And of course, you can always go to GameAudioHour.com, which renders pretty much everything else I just said redundant. So, until next time, bye.